What was that last sentence?
The more I thought, this is bullshit, you know? So, in a strange, distorted, disfigured way, my father was right, you know?
Okay.
He's the one who instilled in me the anti-disestablishmentarianistic question authority. Don't believe anything you hear and only half of what you see. He's the one who beat that into us. I mean, he did it in a fucked up way that no parent should do, but he just didn't have the sophistication. I think he was just too damaged, you know, to have the sophistication of able to instill these values of questioning without, you know, damaging, you know, the way he was trying to instill it.
It wasn't a theory for him. He actually lived
it. It wasn't a theory for him. He was living out the trauma of his life through his kids.
Yeah. You said that was bullshit. I don't know what you were referring to. It was bullshit that he was paranoid, or it was bullshit. You know, you said this sentence. What was bullshit? This is about 2 minutes ago.
Yeah, I realized that what he was saying was in fact true, and that it was bullshit. You know, trying to join, to be a... I was going to say Karl Marx, but I meant to say Groucho.
Yeah.
What did Groucho say?
Any
I never
club.
I never would have belonged to an organization or have me as a member. And, you know, I didn't discover Groucho till later, but when I heard that, I go, that's exactly it.
Yeah.
You never want to belong to an organization or have me as a member. That's why in the Bob world, all the other Bobites are like, I never want to be like that other Bobite. But they are.
They are.
The similarities are far more revealing than the differences.
That's right. So the you as a teenager wanted to join and belong, and then you found, it's like you became an actor. There's the only way you could really, considering your father's conditioning of you, was to join, is to pretend to join in an acting situation.
Yeah.
You act like you joined in a rigorous script that the theater demanded, right? So you're saying that, in the end, acting didn't do it for you.
No, it didn't. And what I found really refreshing and validating and affirming is when I'm listening to Paris, Lamont, and he would say, you know, most actors are really stupid. They're not very sophisticated or educated people.
Yeah.
And he's right. I remember being around all these acting types and thinking, these aren't very erudite people. They're not very learned. They're not interested in thinking and working things out. They're kind of like thugs and punks, like Steve McQueen.
Yeah.
And they're drawn to it for the most superficial of reasons, you know?
And then they become famous and they can't take it because they get no foundation in themselves to deal with the new free time they get, so to speak.
No, and they suffer the effects of the disease of fame.
Yeah.
You know, like Lenny Kravitz, who used to be married to Lisa Bonet, who you knew, you and Carolyn knew Lisa Bonet in New York.
Yeah.
And she used to fucking tell you guys, this guy's a fucking asshole. He beat me up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He's a fucking asshole. And she took Lisa Bonet after she had some TV show on TV, and she kind of walked away from the acting world.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because she knew that it was vulgar and it would fuck you up.
Yeah. So the,
Baudrillard has a great quote in one of his books about Hollywood.
Hmm. You remember it?
I don't. I wish my library was out, Bob, but it will be. In a couple of weeks, I'm going to have all my archives unopened.
Good.
Right now, I'm looking at 100 boxes in my living room. And once they're all out, I'm going to have all of my archives, and I'll be able to refer to stuff. But incredible. Incredible. And you introduced me to Baudrillard. One of the many, many gifts Bob has bestowed upon me over the years. One of the many intellectual bonbons.
Yeah.
So when I look back and I think I can make a list of all, I'm introduced to this, I'm introduced to that, I never would have heard it. Or maybe it would have come my way, you know what I mean, through some ridiculous other source. But the fact that, you know, that you introduced it to me with your own sort of interpretation, it was just unique. So Baudrillard has this great passage where he talks about the dark evil that is Hollywood. And which brings us to David Lynch.
Right.
The
Inland Empire.
Lost Highway. What is after Lost Highway?
The Straight Story?
No.
Mulholland. Mulholland Drive.
Mulholland Drive.
Yes, yeah.
Yes.
And you know, what's interesting, Lynch is always tapping into me in some way, my biography, because the beginning of Mulholland Drive, the young actress wannabe...
From Canada.
From Ontario.
Yes.
I think from Deep River or something, Ontario. And she's a pretty blonde, you know, pretty blonde like Carolyn and many of the girlfriends you've had. So maybe there's a Bob... You know that I say that Dale Coop, that Twin Peaks, is about the transformation of Bob Marshall, you, into Bob, into me. And it ends with him going nuts, right? You know?
Well, Bob, I've been criminally insane, and I've been sane, and there's no difference between the two. It's the systole diastole of sanity, you know, spinning on its, you know, Orphic Baroque spiral between sanity and insanity. It's double-sided Kandinsky. It's the 6 degrees of separation, you know? The double-sided Kandinsky. Chaos, order. Chaos, order. Chaos, order.
Yeah, you said Kandinsky?
Kandinsky. The double-sided Kandinsky. Did you see 6 degrees of separation?
Yes.
The movie. Donald Sutherland, Will Smith.
Yeah.
Woman.
A New York apartment. They end up in a New York apartment.
Right. So Donald Sutherland, you know, is one of the characters, and he owns this double-sided Kandinsky.
Yeah.
So it's a painting that on one side is chaos, and on the other side is order. And it spins, you have to kind of spin it around.
Yeah.
So that there is a blurring effect between chaos and order, which is akin to the systole diastole.
Yeah, the blurred effect. The blurred effect when you look at the heart.
The blurring vortices, blurring effect between chaos, order.
Yeah, because when you look at the heart, it's clear, but if you actually try to focus on it and figure out which direction the parts are going, that's when it blurs out. It becomes a blur.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no real way of assessing the beginning or the ending of this motion.
That's right. So when we met in October 83 and you came to my place, tell us about what you thought you had arrived at.
Well, it was, I remember it was summertime. I think it was, maybe June. I think it was June of 83.
No, October 83 is when we meet at Bob News Party, so it has to be.
Oh, at Bob News. I was thinking about the first time I came to you and Carolyn's house on, where were you living?
That was 22 Kenwood, but that's after.
Kenwood.
That's after October 83.
Right. What happened at Bob News again? I showed up there.
It was a party for all my friends from Nova Scotia and, you know, Don and Jamie, everybody was there.
I'm trying to remember who brought me there. It was so long ago.
I think it was your Queen Street scene. I don't know.
Right. Yes, I showed up there.
It had nothing to do with me. You ended up there.
It had nothing to do with you. It was a great party.
Yeah. And you might have come to my place, and then you especially remember a summer event. I mean, because we would, we'd end up talking late or something. So maybe you're just...
I remember it being a summer day, it was 83. Yeah, it was 83, I think. It was a summer day.
It couldn't have been. You met me in October, unless it was... Well, it could have been November. See,
you know what? No. I think it was the summer of 84 then, when I first came to your house.
Yes, but you know, there could have been... There's warmth in Toronto through November.
Yeah, but I distinctly remember... Bob, you know, I mean, my memory... Sometimes I know there was... I know that it was a nice sunny day. It could have been cold outside. You're right. It could have been cold outside or not. I don't remember the exact thing, but I remember coming upstairs and you had those amazing speakers. I was such a gear fetishist. Even then, you know, I was like, wow. I go, this guy's got to be something because I've never seen speakers like this. They were perfectly round.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a perfect 360-degree cylinder. And the top of it was like a table.
Yes.
And you had the sectional couch on the second floor. Carolyn had her practice.
Yeah.
On the ground floor. I went in through the back door.
Yeah.
And there was a little sign. This is a shoeless home. And I go, oh, I like that. And Carolyn had these paper slippers. So there was a whole stack of these paper slippers. So you come in, you take off your shoes, and you put on these paper slippers.
Yeah, that was for the patients, not up in my level, but for the patients.
But, it was just an incredible environment. And I remember, we talked from about 5 in the afternoon till about 5 in the morning. We talked for 12 hours straight.
Yeah.
And I was walking down the stairs. It's like 4:30 in the morning. I've been there since 5 in the afternoon. Carolyn got to bed. After Carolyn starts, she says goodnight. She goes to bed. She leaves the boys to stay up smoking cigars and discuss their fucking contest of human consciousness. And I remember going, I've been here 12 hours, but I can't leave. And I'm trying to leave, and we take one step, a couple of steps down the stairs, and we go on a tangent, and we go for half an hour, 40 minutes. We take two more steps, go to the... we're trying to get me out of the house, but we're having a very difficult time. But here, I go, this guy's got more fucking stamina than me, and up until that fucking... I had never met anybody who had as much stamina as me. I go, and it became almost like a grudge match. It was like, you fucker, you think you can outlive me? And so that was the beginning. That was the first of many, many hours-long exits where the exit from your house took hours. The exit began like 4 hours beforehand. And I remember feeling my father is this very disturbed, damaged human being. He's very violent. I have some comfort now. And I remember that feeling very distinctly. I thought, I have some comfort now. You know, I've met these two people, you know, Bob and Carolyn, and I know that everything is going to be okay, or it's not. And either way, it doesn't matter.
Well, you once said to me that you always imagined there was a place where there was a neat environment or a neat scene or a neat feeling. Remember that? Talking about that? There was a place where there were neat people or a neat scene happening.
A
utopia.
Well, there was a place. Yeah, there was a place where I felt I fit.
No, you believed there was a place.
Yeah.
And when you got to our place, you figured, oh, that's it. This is the place.
This must be the place.
So then we listened to a lot of Mae Brussel, a lot of Beater, a lot of Zappa.
Oh my God! You just.
I was.
I want to say publicly as Buck Marshall that you have been fucking relentless from the first fucking moment you said hello to me until right now. And you remain relentless.
In a soft way.
In many ways. Your relentlessness has many forms.
Yeah.
You know? It is committed. It is kind. It is cruel. It is fucking punishing. It is rewarding. It's validating. It's diminishing, and it always manifests itself. The relentlessness is constant, and it enjoys many different flavors and many different rainbow colors.
Yeah.
But it's always from a pure place. And sometimes you can doubt that, because I know for myself, Bob, a lot of the times that exposure to a lot of what you've exposed me to has caused me a lot of, pain. And when I was younger, the pain seemed untenable. It seemed like, why is this causing me pain? And then as I evolved and I understood that, the pain was an alchemy to pleasure, or synchronistic with the pleasure.
Mm. Yeah. So what do you think about... In New York, did you watch Krishnamurti tapes with me, or I just gave you Krishnamurti tapes?
Well, a little bit of both. You gave me some Krishnamurti tapes, but you told me to just tune in to Manhattan Cable Network every
Tuesday morning. Tuesday morning.
Every Tuesday morning, you said, listen, just fucking, you know, you're at Claire's, you're in a $1 million condo for free up on the Upper East Side, you got cable, you got everything, just fucking tune in. That became my ritual. Claire went to Bali. Here I am in this huge fucking place all by myself with this cat and the birds and everything.
Yeah.
And that was my ritual. Every Tuesday morning, I'd tune into, you know, Manhattan Cable. And I was like, wow. I was so impressed. I go, wow. I go, I love being here. I go, I could never have this in Toronto. You know, just tune in on Tuesday morning.
Yeah, yeah.
Every Tuesday morning and get, like, you know, a free one-hour experience of Krishnamurti.
On video. And then you would call me up after and be all excited and talking about his reactions to the audience or what he said.
Right. And we'd have a session, a debriefing, and you would talk me down.
So do you think Paris Lamont has a bit of that Krishnamurti elegance? Is that what you're thinking of?
I don't know if I would necessarily characterize it as Krishnamurti elegance. I would characterize it just as
he had a conceptual elegance, whereas Krishnamurti has a perceptual elegance.
That's much closer to what I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah, Flamand is he's erudite. Like I said earlier, he's erudite and he's honest.
He also was he was a fan of Krishnamurti.
Was he?
Yeah, you'll hear that later in the interview.
Now, you know what would be interesting to me? If Paris Flamand would read God, Men, Con Men.
Yeah.
That would be interesting.
Yeah, because at the end you hear him working on the history of mysticism or the secret societies or Blavatsky or something like that. And
at the end of what?
At the end of the interview he talks about what his latest project did it or something. It's a huge book on the history of mysticism. You know that he believes in something, whereas U.G. Krishnamurti would really criticize him. He'd say you're deluded, Paris. You know what I mean?
Did you ever broach the topic of U.G. and AK with Paris?
No, I didn't know of U.G. till last summer, and I interviewed Paris up till May. I interviewed him before I knew of U.G. I just discovered U.G. when I read Bob Carr's book last summer.
Right.
No, but I haven't...
Because the way he spoke of his 100 books of esoterica...
Yeah.
...as being these, you know, very substantial books as opposed to... And you know what was funny? I was listening to him talk about how there's thousands of fucking books out there that are hack jobs.
Yeah.
Crap. And that's exactly what you and Carolyn would say to me. It's like, all this stuff, you know, the crop circles, there's so many hack jobs out there. So the idea that Al Slack would think you guys are New Age flakes is so farcical.
Yeah.
Because if nothing else, I always saw you and Carolyn, the people fucking doing the maverick work, like, you know what? This is good. This is shit. This is good. This is crap. This is good. You know, you were the true sifters.
Yeah.
The original sifters of all of these different post-Aquarian conspiracy modalities, you know, and these ideas and these different special interest groups. And always ahead of the curve, you know. It's like, well, we investigated this and we've discovered that it's crap. But there... It's still good.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes, and Paris Lamont reminds you of that sifting ability.
Exactly. Paris Lamont reminds me of the kind of mind that you and Carolyn possess, where you assess, you're laser sharp, to know that, you know, this may or may not pass muster. We'll see. The jury is out, but we're going to continue to probe.
Yeah.
And he's a real thinker. You know, he's an old style thinker.
Yeah.
Who doesn't take the easy answer.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, he can look at these guys, and he doesn't care about status and about, you know, how people, you know, build them, hoist themselves up. Who gives a shit that you're Steve McQueen? You're a fucking idiot. You don't know anything. And I love that. I love that brutal honesty. And even you try to take him down a couple of roads, and he goes, well, no, I don't think that's it.
That's right. But the brutal
honesty. He's honest.
Yeah,
it's an obsolete virtue.
Yeah, unfortunately. But you can understand why it's obsolete, and you could be brutal about that. That's what I'm brutal about. You can understand why it's been blurred, why everything's blurred. And you can point out the services of it. That's what you get on cash flow. So you like cash flow because it's that seminar kind of quality.
I like cash flow for many reasons.
Yeah.
I like cash flow... Well, in no small part, because James is extremely aware of allowing you to just do your conscious mediumship.
Yeah.
And he's unobtrusive. And the other thing I like about James and the dynamic between you and James is that, you know, he makes a contribution, or he provides content, and he doesn't shy away, and he doesn't shy away from when you assault, or when you become really, you know, out there. And it's a good dynamic.
Yeah, and he's honest about his experience. He has experience. He just lays it out exactly what happened. He's not thinking about what you think of it. He just tells you what happened.
Yeah, he's not running interference with his ego structure.
Yeah.
And I don't know, are we allowed to talk? Well, I don't know if we should say personal stuff you and I have talked about. But
I mean, about James?
Yeah.
No, that's a secret.
No, let's leave it.
Now they're going to wonder what it is.
I don't give a shit. You know what I mean? Like, wondering is what keeps you fucking... It's like the D-cell. The D-cell keeps you wondering.
Yes, yeah. I will just say that James was a serial killer, and he escaped. And
he's a hermonaut.
A what?
Cosmonauts, astronauts, and hermonauts.
What are hermonauts?
A hermonaut is like an astronaut or like a cosmonaut, but of the inner space. So a hermonaut, a hermeneutic, or a hermonaut... H-E-R-M-E-N-A-U-T-I-C, a hermonaut, hermonaut, is an explorer of the inner trip, of the inner mind. So James is a hermonaut. You're a hermonaut as well. You kind of go into the inner space like an astronaut would.
Yeah. And a cosmonaut and a naughty knot.
A cosmonaut, a naughty knot, and an astronaut, because your satellite conditions, Bob's up there circling the fucking, circumnavigating the globe.
Yeah, you know, I just thought, remember on City Island, New York, the license plate, or the signs around City Island was Nautical Capital of New York State or something, nautical, you know, because it was where all the boats were built. And I thought, there it is the old Synarchy, I move in the naughty knots, you know, this decade. The nautical capital of the android meme.
Right. Yes.
Which you've witnessed a lot of my Zanarko.
Oh, I really love City Island. I can remember waiting on a fucking City Island bus after being at your house. Just standing there going, Jesus Christ, I've got to go all the way back to, well, I've got to go all the way back to Manhattan, and then after 9/11, I used to think, fuck, I've got to go all the way back to Brooklyn, which was 2 hours. You take the fucking 2 gallon bars to fucking Pelham Bay.
Yeah.
From Pelham Bay, it's the 456 downtown to fucking Union Square. At Union Square, you got to change over to the Q train. That's another fucking... The cartel you're having. That took me 2 fucking hours. But it was great because, I didn't give a shit. You know what I mean? I was like, I was so delighted to be, well, I spent a lot of time there working for Alex. And he let me live in one of his cottages, remember?
On City Island, yes.
Yeah, I lived in one of his cottages there. I stayed there overnight.
You remember Miles?
Miles still emails me. Can you believe that?
Really?
Yeah, he wants me to get hooked up with some ridiculous guy here in Toronto.
Yeah.
Doing, I don't know what. But how is, you don't hear from Miles, do you?
No, I have him on my bulk list. He gets the photographs and whatever I send out, but he doesn't comment.
Yeah.
I think he's shocked that we ended up in Utopia and he didn't.
Yeah.
Miles was, I always remember, though, about 2004, 2005, he's saying, you see all these houses on City Island? They're all overvalued. It's all going to crash. And he says, is it going to be bad when it crashes?
And, yeah.
So within normal financial world, he was a friend of Mark Stallman's.
I know.
Yeah, and
I like Miles. You know, Miles, in many respects, was he was a sophisticated innocent.
Yeah.
And he was kind.
Yeah.
And I always value a person's kindness, especially, you know, coming from someone like Miles. So.
Yeah, who once was a millionaire, and then he didn't spend it properly and blew it, and then he tried to get back into the scene with the .com,
yeah.
And he was competing with Mark Stallman to create a salon or something. And
yeah.
He used to hang out, you know, spy on Mark and then try to create his own scene. But he knew a lot of important people in New York City, and he was always saying, Bob, I want to introduce you to Ken Ouellette. Well, Ken Ouellette has written a lot of books. A-U-L-E-T-T-E, I think.
I know who he is. I actually know Ken Ouellette's sister. Ken Ouellette, not Ouellette.
Are you sure? Okay, yeah.
I think it's Ouellette, yes, I know. It's Ken Ouellette. And I either met his sister or I met some member of his family, but I know who you're talking about.
And you did that through Miles?
Not through Miles, through my own sources. It's just a coincidence.
Oh, okay. But he wanted me to go and speak before Ken Ouellette's elite circle. Like, he's the one who wrote the biographies of Gates and people like that. He was a New Yorker writer, I think. And he would write the Assess the Business World or something. And I never read many of his books, but he had this salon that Miles would go to, and he says, how do we make you palatable, Bob? How do we cut down the relentlessness and make it a McDonald's burger, you know? He did not want to bring me in there because his reputation was at stake. If he brought in someone they didn't like, then he loses the pecking points, right?
Well, remember when we were at the Museum of Television and History for the screening of The Wake?
Yes, yeah.
And what's this guy? The guy there from, not The New Yorker, the Harper's Magazine.
Lewis Lapham.
Who's the editor of Harper's?
Lewis Lapham.
Lewis Lapham gave the keynote, whatever.
Yeah.
Remember that ridiculousness? Remember that fucking night?
Yes.
Go down to the Museum of Television and, what was it called? Museum of Television
and Radio.
Victor? Radio. The Museum of Television and Radio.
Or Radio and Television, something like that. It's
radio
the archive.
And it's the big fucking thing. It's McLuhan's Wake. And Lewis Lapham is there. And who else is on the fucking program?
Okay, listen to this. Lewis Lapham was the editor of Harper's.
Lewis Lapham.
Yeah, was the editor of Harper's and probably went way back for decades, but he...
No, he still is.
No. Oh, yeah, not anymore, but he still writes a column, maybe. I don't know. But I don't see his magazine much. But Lewis Lapham in 1994 wrote the preface to the MIT publication of Understanding Media. And he...
No.
Oh, yeah. He did the...
Are you serious?
Yes. He did the...
He wrote the preface?
Yes, because it was a mea culpa. He said he was one of the snotty literati of the 60s who thought McLuhan was a joke.
Huh.
And then he talks about... Go to a store and just look at it, you know, get the paper open and read it. It's interesting. And he, of course, as the world unfolded in the 80s and 90s, it didn't make any sense to him. But somehow he reread McLuhan and realized, this guy was totally right.
which is the Thomas Wolfe line. What if he's right?
Yes, yes. And Lewis Laffan, back in the 60s, said, well, he's not even a candidate for that question at that time. That's what Lewis would... He was so disdainful of McLuhan. But
he was so myopic.
Yeah, so you have the McLuhan revival in the 90s. It was appropriate that he write for this prestigious publishing, you know, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, and he represented so much of what the MIT world thought of McLuhan, and they realized they were wrong. So he did that in 94, and of course he has status, so I think he was given a McLuhan Award by the Canadian consulate.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, in 2002, 2003, that series of did you go to any of those? Lance Strait and the Media Ecology Association and Terry McLuhan teamed up with the Canadian consulate and that.
I went to one of those. It was at Robarts, and I was very uncomfortable.
What do you mean Robarts? What's Robarts?
Robarts Library had one. What's the name? Terry McLuhan.
In Toronto?
Yes.
Okay, no, I don't know about that. But let me... Who's the one who was the barber from, kind of, Susan, Sheila, the broadcaster?
Sheila Watson? No.
Sheila, whatever her name is, she was the main News World talking head after Barbara Frum. She got the consulate ambassador role in New York, so she would always introduce... They had David Byrne... They had Adam McGoyan, Tom Wolfe, Jerry Brown, Lewis Laffam, the guy who invented the mouse, Alan somebody from, you know, Silicon Valley. And
Alan Stanfield.
Yeah. Did you meet Alan? You know Alan?
Of course. Don't you remember when I met Alan? He's hilarious. He's like that actor. Who the fuck is that actor? You reminded me of this. I met Alan.
Okay. Who does the new realities TV.
Yeah.
He was a friend of... You would have met him at Harold Channers.
Yes, I did meet him. Remember that big party at Harold Channers?
Yeah.
And everyone's like... Bob's like, well, you know, Ornette Coleman just lives two stories up. And I'm like, can we just go knock at his door?
Yeah. We waited for him to come down, and he never came down. But fortunately, I met him at a private party at Harold.
Yeah, I met Alan Stanfield at Harold. Well, it wasn't his loft; it was his girlfriend's loft.
That's right. It's Alan Steinfield. Stein. I don't know. I can't. Anyway,
Steinfeld.
Yeah. So
I liked him because he had a sense of humor.
Yeah. Well, he was an English. Student scholar in university, so he was an expert on Joyce up to a point.
No, really?
Yeah,
he never presented himself as a learned person. I always thought he was a bit goofy.
Goofy New Age flake, yeah.
Yeah, he presented himself as a goofy New Age flake.
Yeah.
But I had no idea that he was learned.
Okay, so here is Lewis Laffam. So every one of these people, Tom Wolfe, I missed the Camille Paglia and Jerry Brown. Canadian Consulate, Media College Association with, first it was the New School of Social Research, then it was NYU, and there was a previous university. It was like three universities in New York. And I would go to every one of them and sort of raise the big knowing question on these people who are supposed to be honoring or developing McLuhan stuff. And it always stumped them. It always stumped them what I did. And but at the McLuhan's wake, that was a film, you know, sponsored by the National Film Board and TV Ontario, whatever. And we saw the premiere. And on the panel was Laurie Anderson.
Laurie Anderson, who is married to Lou Reed.
Lou Reed.
Laurie Anderson, Lewis Laffam. Who else was up there?
One guy we were waiting for, he got stalled in the plane, was the guy who, one of the early Wired people, John somebody.
Oh, yes.
He started the Electronic Privacy Fund, Electronic Frontier Foundation. Yeah. He was one of the early digerati.
The
original. He was a close friend of John Kennedy Jr.
I was there with Miles, and Stallman was there too, wasn't he? Yeah, he was.
Yeah, no, Stallman was there, and Lou Reed was there.
Lou Reed was there. There wasn't a lot of people. Did you notice that?
There was no interest in McLuhan, really.
I was shocked. I go, fuck, we're like at a premiere with Lewis Lapham, Laurie Anderson, and there was maybe 30 people in the audience.
Yeah.
Ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, the movie wasn't really that great, but nobody knew that.
There's Bob just telling us the truth.
Yeah. I mean, Don Thiel.
Wasn't that great.
No, for neophytes it was okay, but it was really bad.
Yes.
And Don Thiel, you know, McLuhan's greatest student, when he saw it a few years later, he said he got outraged at it. He thought it was such crap.
You know what, Bob? I'm really glad to be hearing this because I was sitting there, and I'm not a neophyte. Even when I was sitting there going, why is everybody getting so fucking worked up over this? It's fucking actually quite mediocre.
Yeah.
So I am really relieved to hear now for the first time that other people shared my fucking criticism that it wasn't fucking all that. Because I thought it was quite... I didn't think it was very good at all.
Yeah. And you remember when you met the guy who played McLuhan in the movie? You met him later.
Yes.
You met Andrew McLuhan.
Yes. Oh, I did meet Andrew. I liked Andrew.
Yeah. Who knew? This was at the naming of the McLuhan Street in.
This is Eric's son.
Yes, and this
who's
is
fucking totally gay, and his father doesn't know it. Oops. Maybe I shouldn't be saying that.
Well, that's your opinion. I don't know if he's gay, but the.
Maybe he isn't.
Yeah, maybe he isn't. Who knows? But
off the record, I want to say that maybe Eric McLuhan is not gay. I just felt that he had a very strong resonance with his feminine nature.
Yeah, you don't. You said Eric McLuhan. You mean Andrew McLuhan, his son.
Yes, Andrew.
Yeah, not Eric. But the thing is, in August 2004, they had a ceremony naming the street that McLuhan lived near and taught for 30 years.
Bob, I was there.
Yeah. It was there that Andrew came up to you, gravitated towards you for some reason, and like an insider said, if you really want to know the good stuff, you call me.
That's very interesting, Bob, that you remember that, because I had no idea who he was until he gave me his card. And I have it here somewhere in one of these boxes. And it was only after I had exchanged maybe two or three sentences with him that he made it known to me that he was Eric's son.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that up until that point. And,
but then he invited you to come stay with him.
Yeah, he invited me to come to Montreal. He invited me to come stay with him, and he invited me to continue our dialogue.
Yeah.
Which I have been remiss in doing. You know what I mean? So.
Well, I picked it up because eventually...
that's right. You did. Because I confided in you. I said, Bob. Because you know me. I always... Whenever I have, like, you know, a Bob experience, I come to you and I present it to you and I lay it at your feet and I go, hey, Bob, this happened. And you were actually quite pleased to hear that I had made this connection with Eric's son.
Yeah. Who I had never met any of his kids. I knew Eric, but I didn't know his kids. And so one thing led to another. You probably gave his email, and I emailed him, and he liked the contact, and probably I talked to him on the phone. And so from that point on, this would be 2005 and 2006, 2007, he said he was going to come to City Island and visit us.
Did he ever do that?
Never happened because he had so many different changes in his life, and he moved around. He lives near Neufeld now.
What's that?
He lives near Dave Neufeld, near Trenton.
He lives near Neufeld. Interesting.
Well, what happened in October 2007, when I was at Neufeld's for a week, Andrew came over, and that's when I first met Andrew. It was at Neufeld's place.
Oh, I remember this.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember being very excited about the fact that I had met Andrew. So, like, when did I meet Andrew?
August 2004.
So I met Andrew in 2004, and then 3 years later, you meet... That's right. He came over to Dave's, and he was so impressed.
Yeah, yeah. Because he was a musician himself. He had a band.
Exactly. But Dave was stressing.
Yeah.
Dave's player. Dave was stressing out. He would Dave would talk to me prior to going, hey, you know, Eddie, the fucking bomb is driving me. I can't get any more than he's taking over.
Yeah, we brought.
And I was trying to come up to visit.
Yeah.
And Dave's like, you know, Eddie, I can't handle it. I can't take anymore.
That's right, because we not only brought in Eric McCoy's son, we brought in Nelsenthal's son.
Yeah. Here's Bob fucking takes over Dave's fucking studio.
Just like Eugene Krishnamurti.
He takes over his house. He takes over his church. He takes over Dave's life. He takes over his answering machine. He's got fucking the CIA calling, trying to hunt Bob down.
That's right. The criminal division of the IRS left a message.
The criminal division of the IRA, the IRS, hunt Bob down in front of a gate fucking backwater fucking studio in buttfuck Canada. Which freaks Dave out. He's like, Jesus Christ, Bob, you brought the fucking guards down. You brought the cops down of my house.
You brought the Galen Network into my sacred chapel.
And we know how paranoid fucking Dave is.
Yes.
That was great.
The thing is, it was there at his place. I was there for a week. Oh, I wanted to say, it's just like when you read Bob Carr's book, God, Men, Con Men. When Eugene Krishnamurti came to town and everything stopped and everybody had to deal with Eugene, that was what I did to him. I did a Eugene on Neufeld.
Exactly. You were replaying the Eugene effect.
Yeah.
Which was what you do when you go on your, the Bob Dobbs fucking World Tour 2007.
Yeah.
Bob Dobbs World Tour 2003 or whatever it is. You blow into New Zealand, you blow into Canada. Wherever you fucking stop, you create fucking chaos and order. Chaos and order. So here's Bob. Bob's coming off the plane. He's going through the airport. You have anything to declare? Yeah, just systole, diastole. Can we allow this in the country? Yeah, systole, diastole. That's all I have to do. Did you buy anything while you were abroad? Yes, I'm bringing in some systole, diastole. Can we clear that through customs? I guess so.
Let me spell that. S-Y-S-T-O-L-E hyphen D-I-A-S-T-O-L-E. Systole, diastole is a technical name for the action of the pumping heart. Right?
Which is when you observe it with the human eye, the actual function of the systole, diastole is almost imperceptible in the sense that after a while there's a hypnotic effect. You don't know which action is which. So one merges, matches, and makes with the other.
Yeah.
So much so that it's almost one singular motion. So there's no real distinction. Is that about right, Mark?
Yep. There's
blurring. There's a blurring effect between, is this going cystic or diastic?
It's pulsation.
Or diastic.
It's pulsing. I don't know if you can say it's spiraling. Maybe it's radiating.
No, it's not spiraling. It's pulsing and it's not pulsing.
Yeah. Yeah,
but
it's pulsing and not pulsing.
The pulsing are imperceptible in a way.
Yeah.
So much so that they're all one action.
Yeah, yeah.
So the only thing that separates them is the use of the English language. If we didn't have the words systole and diastole, and we had no concept of language, we would be just looking at the visual effect, and we would know that it was one thing. The only thing that makes it two things is the use of language.
Right, and you can't know the object stone unless you have the word stone. So you see the systole and diastole because you have the words for it. So it's pulsing and rippling, yet at the same time, a muscle punching.
Yeah.
Tensing, maybe.
So,
pulsing, yeah, rippling, and tensing.
Rippling and tensing.
And pulsing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So back to
back to the invasion of Dave's fucking studio.
Yeah, yeah. Which he was glad to announce to be Dobbstown North, because we're going to Costa Rica, which will be Dobbstown South, and Dave will be working there and playing there. But so he had always offered me and Carol to stay there. So I finally get there, and we have a great time. But after a few days, it gets tense for Dave, because he does have projects to do, and he's not really able to focus on it because too much other stuff's happening. And so we have diplomatic visits by Andrew McLuhan and Nelson Thal's son. all not arranged. See, the point is, I go to Toronto, and I haven't talked and seen Nelson Thal since 2002, but his wife, his divorced wife, invites me over to the place in 1st of October, right after I get there in 2007, and there's young Nelson Thal. So I meet him. I knew him from 5 years before, and so we reconnect, and he wants to hang out, and then he has a studio, recording studio. They put out, he and his brother put out an album. So when he hears about Dave, who he knew of Dave when he was a kid, he wants to go see Dave's place. So that was that must have been how I got driven out there. I think that's how I got out there. I got him to drive me out there.
Yeah.
So anyways, while I'm there, the criminal division of the IRS leaves a message. They need to talk to me about the stuff that nobody believes I'm involved in, but I'm involved in. And you know, I told you that when Neufeld was here a couple weeks.
Can I just say something, Bob?
Yeah.
For the people who may not know this, who may be listening to this, you know, we're talking about Dave Neufeld, who was beaten up and falsely fucking arrested and charged by the New York cops. So he's already got a level of paranoia, right?
Yeah.
So here's the IRS criminal division leaving fucking messages on his home fucking, his private home studio fucking answering machine.
Right. And he got beat up.
I just wanted to embed that level.
Yes. And he's the one, the producer, the genius behind Broken Social Scene, and the founding of the Canadian Indie Movement in 2002. Dave was on his way to meet me at Central Park when he got beat up.
Wow.
And
I didn't know that. That's one part of the story that I never knew. I didn't know what the fuck. He wasn't in Central Park. He was in Washington Square Park. Wrong. Not Central Park. Washington Square Park.
Yeah,
he was downtown.
Yes,
because Broken Social Scene was playing a show at the Bowery Ballroom.
No. They were playing at Central Park.
Am I wrong?
Yeah. Dave arrives at midnight on some day, and he gets busted, and he's in jail for the next, like, 2 days or 36 hours or something.
Yeah.
But he's to be on stage with Broken Social Scene at the Central Park Summer Concerts. I think it was in July.
Oh, okay. I did get it wrong. I thought it was the Bowery Ballroom.
So it was set up that I would meet him at the Central Park place where they have these concerts, summer concerts. And I get there at 6 o'clock, and I walk around, and I'm waiting for hours, well, an hour and a half, and he doesn't show up. So then I go back home, and Dave's going to stay at my place. I don't hear from him for a week. I don't know what happened to him.
Because he's in the tombs, as they say.
And then
he's in the tombs.
Yeah, and he shipped back. I don't know if maybe they got him out to Chicago, and then he went back to Toronto. But he has to recover because he's all beat up. And he doesn't get healthy enough, really, to call me until a week later, and he calls up and apologizes for not being at the meeting.
And tells you the whole drama.
Yes, and I tell him, something good's going to happen out of this, Dave. Do not worry about it. You are going to get something good. And what happened? Right when he got that studio in Trenton in 2007, in the spring, he had the down payment, but then after a couple months, he couldn't carry it. But then all of a sudden, even though there's been a big delay, the money came in. He got $70,000 from the New York cops. They paid him back, or you know, he won the case. So that saved him keeping the chapel, the huge church, the remarkable studio he's built. If he hadn't have got beat up, he wouldn't have had the cash 2 years later which I think he got beat up in 2005. So he wouldn't have had the cash to create the thing that he has now, which is his perfect paradise. What he has going now.
Okay. So let's try to see that whole event through the prism of the Bob effect.
Yeah.
So here he is on his way to meet Bob. Fucking calamity befalls him. The catastrophe befalls him. He's beaten up. He's busted. So in the immediate interval, all he sees is the negativity of this event.
Yes, because he...
Bob, hold it.
He was going to meet that next day a big band and get a $250,000 contract.
Yes, to work with one of Paul McCartney's musicians in L.A. I know all about that.
Yeah.
But check this out. So the calamity befalls him on his way to meet, on his way waiting for Bob, or on his way to meet Bob, the calamity or the catastrophe befalls him. So Dave only sees the negative aspect of this. I've been beaten up. I'm fucked up. I've lost my contract to go down to L.A. Everything's fucked up. But what happens, Bob says, don't you worry, Dave. I'm reassuring you that even though your fucking coming to meet me resulted in fucking pain, there will be fucking pleasure later.
Yes.
So just at the right juncture in his life, when he needs that $70,000, Bob cashes him out. He goes, here you go, Dave. Here's your $70,000 for being so patient and suffering. So Bob giveth and Bob taketh away.
But mostly giveth. It just takes a while sometimes.
Mostly giveth.
Yeah.
No, Bob always giveth. Though sometimes it may be dressed up or masquerading as taketh, you need to make the fucking insight and realize that what seems like taketh now will become giveth later.
Yeah. And he realizes that now. But he was so... Yeah. You know, despondent at that point.
Well, but that's in Dave's nature.
Yeah.
Dave has a proclivity to be despondent, to be, I'm the aggrieved one. I'm the one being fucked over by broken social scene and everybody else and all that shit.
I just got a pattern. He had it worse than your father. Remember, the Evergreens told him that he was killed in the concentration camp as a Jew in the 40s. So he he didn't survive it. Your father did. But he didn't.
Well, my father survived only in the chemical body. But my father's astral, TV, chip, and fucking mystery body all slaughtered.
Yeah.
The only thing that survived for my father was his chemical body.
Yeah, and that was an after image.
It was an after image. So here's my father walking like this shell of a fucking after image ghost.
Yeah.
Which, for all you neophytes out there, is a standard Bob inflection. Practice with me. Come on. I'm teaching one of the fucking introductory courses.
So Dave, the Evergreens told him that he has to deal with this persecution problem because of the, he had it in a past life, and it resonates with his life.
Well, that's interesting, you know, because total biology never addresses past life. Biology only discusses this, you know, this incarnation and what happens, you know, through the traumas and dramas of this incarnation.
Yeah. And they go through the DNA or the experience in your ancestors, which connect to the person you are in this life.
Right.
I mean, the Evergreens say that when you reincarnate, there of the 15 or 3,000 lives you have all happening all at once, and you pick a life, one of them to live, there are only about 10 of them that resonate with that life. So only 10 of your past lives resonate with this one.
Right.
So when I had my past life readings from the Evergreens, they pointed out the different lives that resonated with this one. Not many of many other lives would resonate with a different life, not this one.
Huh. Yeah.
And that's a sophistication that you've never heard of in whatever past life regression therapies people have. You know, they don't go into that level.
It's interesting that you bring up past life regression. I remember... maybe 15, 17 years ago, I remember talking to Carolyn about past life regression, and I remember her being very cautionary. She said, you know, Eddie, I wouldn't recommend it, because I got very interested in past life regression, and she said, you know, when you do past life regression...
Wait a minute, did she say she got very interested in it, or is she saying, or
no,
you?
No, I did.
Okay.
I got very interested in it. So I went to Carolyn to ask her about it. I don't know why I didn't ask you about it, but I went to Carolyn to ask her about it. Because I think Carolyn and I were talking about past life regression.
Were you a patient of Carolyn?
Huh?
You were a patient of Carolyn.
Yeah, of course I was.
Yeah, so that might have been in the medical patient context.
Maybe. You know how my being a patient of Carolyn and being a personal friend got blurred?
Yeah.
Anyway, in a conversation with Carolyn many years ago, I remember discussing past life regression. And I remember what Carolyn said. She said, Eddie, I wouldn't recommend it because when you get regressed by a past life regressor, you're completely susceptible to contamination or direction.
Suggestion.
By this person.
Suggestion.
She said, I would not recommend it. So I thought, okay, you know what? I don't need to get past, you know, go into past life regression because I don't know, unless I trust this person, what they're going to fucking implant in me or direct me or, you know, I'm too susceptible, I'm too vulnerable.
The word is suggestion.
Suggestion.
Yeah, what they suggest in you.
Exactly.
And so, you just bring that. But what I'm saying is that the idea that certain lives, let's say the past life regression, I've never done it. I don't know what happens, but
it's dangerous.
Yeah, no, but you go back and I don't know if it's dangerous, but you go back and retrieve a life in your unconscious, and you talk about it. It may not be the life that resonates with this life.
Well, yeah, of course.
That's the point. The subtle point there, Reans, is you got to know what aspects of previous lives resonate with the task or aimlessness of this life. The drift of this life.
Yes.
And so I got told to some points about past lives, and I could totally see how what I did in one life reflected what I did in this life in a, you know, very personal way, very hard to get into, maybe not relevant to people. But we're talking about this because how do we get into this?
We went down this conversational thread. From talking about Dave.
Oh, Dave and his past life.
His trauma,
yeah.
And his father and the Nazis and all of that. And
right.
You said that Dave's father has suffered more than mine or something to that effect.
So here we are. I'm at his place. And it was at his place I put on the computer. This is middle of October 2007. And I listened to James Martinez's Cash Flow. And him and John Statmiller. James has been doing it for a few months. And Dave watched me, and I called in, and you can see the transcript or listen to it in my archives. I call in, and they keep me on the line for like half an hour, and I critique what James and John are saying. And that was that, and then you can hear what they say about me after the break when I leave. But Dave listened to me. But that show, when you listen to me getting on cash flow starting in January, when I become a regular contributor with James at his request, I'm explaining what I had said in that 30 minutes on October 17th or whenever, you know, on that call-in. It's the same message, the same elaboration, same themes. And John Statmiller couldn't take it after a while. Couldn't get it. So I started the whole castle thing at Dave's place.
Huh.
So then Dave came here a couple weeks ago. He must have arrived. He left on March 1st, so he was here for 9 days.
And I know that.
Yeah, and he got to witness me talking to a member, one of the main members of the Secret Council of Ten. He's the only citizen person not in the inner circles who saw this. And he just had to be here when my associate called. And he heard the person asking me. He couldn't hear the voice, but he could hear what was being said because I would respond to the guy's questions. And he heard me discussing the Android meeting, the Post Information Society, all these old Bob themes.
Bob, who are we talking about?
The richest man in the world.
Oh, that's what I said. I was about to say, we're talking about Bill.
Yeah, we call him Bill.
Okay, good. Well, fine, because I was a little confused. I was like, I knew who you were talking about, but I wasn't 100% sure. So,
right.
Yeah, I remember you telling me about that privately in one of our phone conversations.